ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Anthony Albanese goes big on bulk billing in his core pitch for re-election. Within 5 years, Labor's promising 9 out of 10 GP visits will be bulk billed. And the Coalition says it won't stand in the way of this new spending. I'm David Spears. Welcome to Insiders. Behind in the polls and with an election imminent, the Prime Minister is today unveiling a bold and big spending pitch to all Australians. Labor is promising to dramatically expand existing bulk billing incentives. It wants thousands of GP practices to shift to a new model where they bulk bill every patient. It won't come cheap. The price tag is $8.5 billion over the first 4 years. But Labor's banking on this being popular and is hoping to build some cost of living momentum after Tuesday's interest rate cut.
Households across this country are hoping for much needed relief from the rising cost of living today.
Economists are widely forecasting the Reserve Bank will cut the official cash rate.
So they have just decided to cut the interest rates. We're just hearing by, what was that?
I believe 25 basis points.
25 basis points.
Yes, that's right.
This is the rate relief that Australians need and deserve.
Well, they haven't been a cut since 2020.
Just that peace of mind that it is going down.
What we are seeing is that we're heading in the right direction.
But how difficult was this decision today?
It wasn't a lay down, this air.
For many Australian families, this will be too little, too late.
Angus Taylor looked like someone had run over his cat in the driveway yesterday. He looked so disappointed.
The Prime Minister might be doing high fives with the Treasurer, but I know there are a lot of families who are still struggling to pay their grocery bill.
This is the soft landing that we have been planning for and preparing for.
Federal and South Australian governments will fund a $2.4 billion rescue package for the Whyalla Steelworks, labelling it an investment in the nation.
You're going to get paid, your futures are secure.
This decision today is a vote of confidence in Whyalla, in the region and in the future.
I've been here 25 years and this is a good day.
The frustration and the uncertainty is what the killer is.
The Steelworks, which employs 1,100 people directly, was taken over by billionaire businessman Sanjeev Gupta's GFG Alliance in 2017 after it had gone into administration.
People have seen this before in the transition from Arium to GFG.
Oh, Whyalla, wipe out there on my TV.
We don't want a rerun.
Bailout or rescue package, it is intervention. Taxpayer money being used to save jobs and an industry.
We will be allocating funds from our $1 billion green iron investment fund that we have created.
We'll provide the same amount of money, but not the green hydrogen hoax product. It's just not going to work.
We are a government that back a future made in Australia.
My guest this morning is Treasurer Jim Chalmers. First, let's check what's making news, and plenty of coverage of the government's bulk billing bonanza this morning with details of how the plan would work. The Prime Minister will hold a campaign-style rally in Launceston later today to talk up this cornerstone election policy. We'll discuss that further in a moment. Three Chinese warships have carried out a second round of live firing exercises in the Tasman Sea. The New Zealand Defence Force says one of its frigates observed a Chinese cruiser firing its main gun. Australia's yet to receive a satisfactory answer from China as to why more notice wasn't given before a similar incident on Friday. And finally, a major push by Australian superannuation companies to win over the Trump administration begins this week in the United States. The government's hoping this four-day showcase will help convince Donald Trump not to impose tariffs on Australia by demonstrating how heavily Australians are investing in the US through their super. It's trying to cut through to the US president with a blunt promotional video featuring actors portraying working Australians who list off investments in the US, including a number of swing states.
A pool of trusted capital from your long-term ally.
Ready to invest in America's future.
Super for us.
And super for the US.
The industry says Australia's super is now the fourth largest pool of capital in the world and on track to be the second largest within a decade. Well, the government's hoping its bold plan to ramp up bulk billing will be an election-defining issue. While bulk billing rates have climbed for pensioners and concession card holders, for everyone else, they've been steadily falling. The number of people in their 20s who don't go to the doctor because it costs too much has tripled over recent years. This policy pitch is about cost of living as much as it is about health. And GPs have welcomed the move, but warn it doesn't mean everyone will necessarily be bulk billed. The opposition, meanwhile, says it won't stand in the way. Despite this big new spend, it wants to avoid an election fight over health. Let's see what the panel makes of it. We're joined this week by Jacob Greber, Jennifer Hewitt and Shane Wright. Good to have you all here. Let's start on this big... I'm told it's the biggest pre-election policy commitment we'll hear from the government, so the campaign can't be too far off, you wouldn't think, Jacob. Will this work, though, the idea of boosting or expanding the existing incentive for bulk billing to everybody and then a new top-up incentive if a practice bulk bills all patients? Will it work?
Well, the expectation will be raised after today with the way this has been announced, and I think specifically the promise, the idea that 9 out of 10 people will be able to show up and not have to reach for their credit card. That's what the Prime Minister's saying. A lot of that will depend on how the GP clinics themselves respond to these incentives. People in this space tell me that that's not necessarily guaranteed, particularly in the metro areas where the cost of running these clinics is higher, the rents are higher, the staff wage costs are higher, and they're not covered by that rebate. So that'll be an interesting test, how those GPs react to this.
And to be clear, they can still continue as they do, charging a gap fee in those areas.
Exactly. They just won't get this 12.5% top-up. They need to go to full bulk billing to get that. Look, it'll be popular, I suspect. People are feeling the pinch when they go to the doctor. The statistics tell us that people are putting off visits. Those sorts of numbers have gone up as these cost of living pressures mount. And so I think the government is very keen to pitch this as relief on a sensitive part of people's spending.
Yeah, cost of living is as much as health, as I say. Now, clearly the opposition knows this is going to be popular as well, because in a heartbeat, Jennifer, they've said, we're not going to stand in the way. They also, earlier in the week, backed in very promptly the Whyalla steel money, and we'll come to that a little later in the program. But on this one, the opposition clearly understand that this will be popular. But saying we won't stand in the way, does that mean they would do it themselves if they win the election?
Well, I'm sure they'll be pressed on that, and Labor will be desperate to kind of get another Mediscare campaign up because, of course, as the Liberals all too well remember, that's very effective. That was used in 2016 to great effect. So I think in the end they'll be pressed to say that they'll go ahead with it because otherwise Labor will just continue by saying how this is, you know, they're going to ruin Medicare and this will be a shocking thing. Don't forget, of course, this also comes on top of the government already providing lots of extra support for people with kids or concession holders. So this is really that targeted at that... those, you know, adults who don't have any kids or who aren't pensioners. But the catch is, of course, is it's just yet more spending.
It is more spending. Look, just you're right. It's aimed at that middle, isn't it? And you know, a lot of working Australians who can't get a bulk billing doctor at the moment. But the cost of this and the spending, 8.5 over the next 4 years. This is ongoing or recurrent spending, Shane. How's it going to be paid for?
Well, that's one of the great mysteries, isn't it, of the budget process, that there's this argument from the government that some of this or all of this has been accounted. It's not just the bulk billing. There's the incentives to get more people to be trained as GPs. There's a cost in that area because there's no use promising we'll have free access to a GP if the GP doesn't exist. So you can there's that extra spend. Whether it's been baked into the overall budget, we will see probably in a pre-election fiscal outlook, the PFO.
You don't think we'll get a budget?
We're not going to get a budget, sadly. And I love a budget. We all love budgets here.
We'll see if the Treasurer can confirm that for us.
I think he'll be wary in committing himself. But
Shane's called it now.
That's it. Yeah. But this is the issue of, yes, Jennifer's absolutely right. This is more spending being baked in bipartisanly at this point.
Well, this is the thing. Does it, for the coalition, they have talked about belt tightening, we've got to cut spending and so on, but they're waving this one through, the Whyalla money through.
We haven't seen, this whole argument about this huge increase in spend, the single biggest increase is the GST. the way it's treated in the budget. Mm-hmm. That's more than a quarter of the entire increased spend under this current government. I don't think the opposition's planning on saying we're not going to give money to the states. So where you can cut sort of falls very, very quickly.
The Greens welcome this. This is along the lines of things they've been calling for. They want Parliament called back tomorrow so that this can be passed through. I don't know if it needs legislation, though, does it, Jake?
My information is that it's a regulation rather than a thing that needs to be legislated.
Okay.
Now, regulation can obviously be overturned by votes, but it's essentially gets baked in.
And the plan at the moment is it wouldn't start till November, so there'd be time, to do that.
There'd be plenty of time for grandstanding by everybody.
Yeah, and you know, I guess the slight nuance in this is maybe does this mean that the coalition's putting it into its books, as it were, or whether it leaves it sort of vague?
Yeah, that still isn't clear from the opposition. But for the government, you know, clearly after the interest rate cut, Whyalla money, big announcement today on this bulk billing front, it does feel like the campaign's not too far off, right?
Well, of course. And we're putting up core flutes. We've got, you know, big set pieces already happening today, for instance, in Tasmania, in Launceston, the Prime Minister's getting up. So the momentum is very much campaign, campaign, campaign. And, of course, one side puts a big, bold thing up, like this bulk billing thing. The other side's reacting very, very fast to it to try and neutralise any sense that, as Jenny said, there's a split here on this particular issue. And it's the coalition remembers well the 2016 campaign where this Medicare scare really, really was very effective in eating into Malcolm Turnbull's majority. Mm-hmm. They've never forgotten that. I think they're more prepared this time not to fall into that trap. But this is essentially the fight the government is trying to pick with the opposition to create a real sense of difference between it and the opposition.
And remind people about Peter Dutton's time as health minister. On the rate cut, plenty of people expected that on Tuesday. It happened. The Reserve Bank governor, though, was pretty cautious in saying, you know, don't get your hopes up for another cut anytime soon necessarily. We're going to be data dependent here. We then saw the jobs figures on Thursday that came in pretty strong. And Michelle Bullock was before the House committee on Friday and was asked about that and did seem to indicate she thinks the jobs market might still be too hot.
The question is it a little too tight to sustain, to continue to bring inflation back down to the target and sustain there? That's the million-dollar question. Some people think it is perfectly consistent. We're a little more wary. We think it's a little bit too tight, but... You know, we're constantly re-examining our assumptions on this basis.
We still think it's a bit too tight. What does that mean, Shane?
Well, this is really interesting because this is a huge debate within the Reserve Bank at the moment because they think you need unemployment around 4.5% to take inflation pressures out of the jobs market.
It's at 4.1 now.
Right? It's at 4.1 and it will fall next month because of just the way that some of the statistical noise that's going on. However, the day before the job figures was the wages figures. The wage price index fell and it was 0.005%, like this much away from being well short of where the Reserve Bank actually had forecast just on Tuesday. This goes to this whole argument. Wages growth is slowing, but we've got a super strong jobs market there, which created 54,000 full-time jobs in January. So the bank's... Michelle Bullock mentioned this in the press conference about we are going outside to have a debate and talk to people who are saying, hold on, this magical rate of unemployment may be lower than where we think. Treasury thinks it's lower. Plenty of private sector economists are saying, look at the wages sector, look at what's going on in jobs. You guys have got it wrong. It's a really interesting debate at the moment.
So we may not get another mid-campaign rate cut, but we got one on Tuesday. Will that make a difference, do you think, to the government's fortunes, Jennifer?
Well, it certainly helped. What I think you could say is if they hadn't had a rate cut, that would have been very, very bad for the government.
Yeah.
The people will be... happy to some extent, but they're still talking about, you know, cost of living. They're still not very happy. They're a very sullen electorate. Mm. And all the government's kind of cost of living measures and things really haven't changed that attitude. Mm. So they're not, in a sense, they're not so much pro the Dutton. They're just kind of anti-Labor at the moment as the kind of the mood. And so this is why this next period is going to be particularly important and why it's so vital for the government to try and say, look, things are getting better, our story is getting better, and you can't trust the Liberals. I just think it's a little too early. It's certainly a little too far too early to claim victory on inflation.
Well, let's see what the Treasurer has to say about it. Time to talk to Jim Chalmers. And to take us there, he was the Shadow Treasurer this morning, vowing the Coalition won't stand in the way of this new government spend on bulk billing.
Now, we're not going to get in the way of Labor cleaning up the mess that it has made. And it's important that that mess be cleaned up. What should have happened is we should have kept the gains or the benefits that we'd had when we were in government, that higher level of bulk billing, that lower level of out-of-pockets, but Labor's failed again.
Jim Chalmers, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, David.
So the Shadow Treasurer says they're not going to stand in the way of this. Do you welcome that?
Oh, very tricky language, I thought, from the Shadow Treasurer, Angus Taylor. And no matter what they say today, you can't trust Peter Dutton with Medicare. And we know that because he can't find $600 billion for nuclear reactors, which will push energy prices up, without coming after Medicare again, just like he did when he was the health minister.
Now, what about the money here, $8.5 billion? Where will that come from?
Well, the $8.5 billion is a substantial investment, but it's a responsible investment as well. It's hard to think of a more appropriate use of public funds than to strengthen Medicare and help with the cost of living. What this means is more doctors and more bulk billing and less pressure on household budgets. Around $5.4 billion of the $8.5 billion that we're announcing today we already provisioned for in the mid-year budget update. And this shows what's possible when you help engineer a $200 billion improvement in the budget, you knock out those two surpluses to pay down Liberal debt. This is what's possible when you do that. You make room for what really matters to Australians and in communities, and particularly in household budgets, and it's hard to think of a more important investment than this.
You mentioned the two previous surpluses, but you have forecast for the coming financial year a deficit of $46.9 billion. So will this additional spending require more borrowed money, or are you cutting somewhere else?
Well, we'll have the best combination of budget improvements and investments like this one. And what we have demonstrated in our first three budgets, and we will demonstrate in the fourth, is to strike the right balance. We found $92 billion worth of savings in the budgets. We've banked most of the upward revisions to revenue from a stronger labour market and good commodity prices. We've delivered those two surpluses. We've got the Liberal debt down by more than $170 billion. We've acted on the structural pressures on the budget, whether it be interest costs, aged care or the NDIS. And what all of that shows is you can make room for these sorts of investments. We've already provisioned for most of this in the mid-year budget update. The investment is important, it's substantial and it's responsible, but let's not lose sight here of the main objective, strengthening Medicare to help with the cost of living. More doctors and more bulk billing means less pressure on household budgets. Cost of living has been a major focus of this Albanese Labor government, and that will continue.
But listening to you, it sounds like everything's fine with the budget, and yet, as I say, you've got some big deficits forecast as far as the eye can see. Ken Henry, of course, the former Treasury Secretary, he says there's no plan to control government spending. Is he right or wrong?
No, he's not right in this instance. You know that I've got a lot of respect for Ken. I work very closely with him. But I think that ignores the very substantial progress we've made on the budget. That $200 billion nominal improvement in the budget is the biggest that we have ever seen. Those two surpluses were the first in almost two decades. The fact that we've got that Liberal debt down by $170 billion or so is saving us on interest costs. And all of this means that we can make room to invest in what really matters, and that is stronger Medicare and help with the cost of living. People are under a lot of pressure in their household budgets, and this will help to ease some of that pressure.
The spending you forecast for the next financial year is the highest in about 40 years outside of the pandemic, 27.2% of GDP. Will it now be even higher? Will we see a budget that lays all of this out before the election?
What you see in the budget is that spending as a share of the economy peaked, I think, at about 31.4% from memory during COVID, and we've been able to get that down. We got it all the way down to about 25%.
But is COVID a fair comparison here? Over 40 years outside of COVID, this is the highest it's been.
Yeah, the point that I'm making, David, is we've got that down since COVID. That's been deliberate. There are some pressures on the budget which come from things like The growth in the care economy, the fact that we have an ageing population, our responsibilities when it comes to national security. Again, those are substantial investments, but responsible investments. What we've shown is an ability to manage the budget in the most responsible way, and that makes room to strengthen Medicare and help with the cost of living.
Obviously, the government's been having a go at Peter Dutton over his plans to cut back on the public service. The Victorian Labor Premier is now doing the same. Jacinda Allen's ordered a review. It could lead to thousands of public service job cuts. What do you think of that?
Well, we haven't seen the outcomes of the review from the Victorian government. What we've shown as the Albanese Labor government is we've found a way to wind back expensive contractors and consultants in the public service and to replace them by rebuilding capacity in the public service itself. A lot of the numbers that you see bandied around are driven by the fact that we've had to clean up the mess we inherited in areas like the huge backlog, the shameful backlog in veterans claims. And so that's driven some of the numbers that you'll see. We've found $92 billion worth of savings in the budget. We've done that in a responsible way. And again, there's an important contrast here. Peter Dutton wants to build $600 billion worth of nuclear reactors. He says there'll be cuts in the budget. He told you that in the last couple of weeks, but he said we won't tell the Australian people what those cuts are until after the election. That can only mean one thing. You can't pay for $600 billion in nuclear reactors without coming after Medicare again like he did last time, without coming after veterans and pensions and housing.
On interest rates, you've welcomed the rate cut on Tuesday as deserved and needed. Look, we may not get another one, though, anytime soon, seems to be the warning from the Reserve Bank Governor. We just heard earlier Michelle Bullock saying that the jobs market's still a little bit too tight in her view. What do you think?
Well, I'm not going to make predictions about future movements in rates.
But the jobs market, is it too tight?
Oh, what we've shown as Australians is that we can deliver very low unemployment at the same time as we make substantial and now sustained progress on inflation. If you look at the combination of developments in our economy, you can see that our economy is turning a corner in at least five positive ways. We've got inflation down, wages are up, unemployment is very low. We've got the Liberal debt down, and now interest rates have started to be cut as well. And all five of those developments are very good developments. It shows we can get inflation down, we can see interest rate cuts without sacrificing the gains that we've been making in the jobs market. Average unemployment under this Albanese government is actually the lowest of any government in the last 50 years. We've been able to do that at the same time as we've got inflation down. Inflation and interest rates were higher and rising when we came to office. Now both are falling at the same time as we've maintained very low unemployment in our economy.
Let me ask you about the $2.4 billion being spent to keep the Whyalla Steelworks going and upgrade it. Can you just clear this up? Is the government going to own this plant or part of this plant?
Well, this is a reflection of our belief in the town of Whyalla, the broader region, the future of steel, the future of manufacturing and a future made in Australia. And what these investments are all about is keeping the steel plant open while we look for a more enduring, longer-term solution. And if you think about what we're doing in Whyalla, what we're doing in relation to REX, this is all about supporting regional communities and workers and jobs. It's about supporting the national interest. In both of those instances, our preference and our objective is for a private sector buyer. But we are prepared to play a role, and that's what you've seen, because we believe that Australia's golden opportunity in this world of churn and change is at the intersection of our resources base, our industry base, our skills and the energy transformation. And the investments that we are making enthusiastically with the South Australian Government in Whyalla are a reflection of that.
OK, but if you can't find the right buyer at the right price, this will be a government-owned steelworks.
Well, look, we'll work through all the contingencies, but that's not our preference. If you look at the support that we announced with Premier Malinauskas during the course of the week, there's some administration funding, there's some support for the local community and local small businesses, and there's support from the Green Iron Fund, which is all about making sure that Australia can grab the opportunity which is presented by the way that the world is changing. And we want to be part of that. We want to get a slice of the action for our workers and communities, including in that great part of South Australia.
You mentioned that Green Iron Fund that's been set up to pay for this improvement at the plant. What's green about it?
Well, it'll be a very robust and rigorous fund, and what makes it green is that the Guarantee of Origin scheme will help ensure that the investments generate emissions reductions in a really big part of our emissions. I think from memory, emissions in that part of the economy are about a tenth of the emissions come from that sector. And so any progress that we can make here will be meaningful, and we'll have all of the right arrangements in place to make sure that the output is green.
But they're going to be using gas in the furnace.
Well, there are ways to measure the emissions reductions, obviously, in this really important part of the economy, big part of our emissions, and we'll have all of the robust and rigorous arrangements in place.
Can you also clear up, will the government introduce quotas for local steel to be used in major projects in Australia? The PM hinted at this the other day. What's the plan there?
Oh, it's something that we're looking at. You know, we're looking at the procurement part of this, but already I think something like 75% of the steel out of Whyalla goes to things like railways in Australia, infrastructure projects, so that there's already a big opportunity there. And if there's more that we can do, more that we can think through on that front, obviously we'll do it.
But there, you know, there's likely to be more cheap Chinese steel available pretty soon. If you introduce quotas, could that push up construction costs in Australia if they have to use this locally made steel?
Oh, look, we'll think through all of those possible implications, but we want Australian steel used in Australian projects. There's no doubt about that already. There's a big chunk of the steel that comes out of Whyalla used in Australian projects. That's a very good thing. Okay. If there are responsible ways that we can enhance that, of course we'll consider it.
So quotas are on the table?
We're thinking through all of those options when it comes to procurement.
So, look, whether you do quotas, all this government investment in steel works, aluminium fund, you're investing in making solar panels, quantum computer, maybe buying Rex, is there a danger that all of this government intervention, and you know, to be fair, Peter Dutton wants government-built nuclear power plants as well, that this brings on Donald Trump's tariff threat? He's threatening reciprocal tariffs for, you know, these sort of local supports. Is there a threat here?
Oh, I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, already out of Whyalla, for example, I think 90% of the steel out of Whyalla, I think from memory, is used for domestic purposes here in Australia. Obviously, there is an ongoing conversation about tariffs on steel and aluminium. Every country that produces steel and aluminium is thinking through the potential consequences of that. But our relationship with the US is a mutually beneficial one. The Americans run a substantial trade surplus with us. They have since the Truman administration, 1952 or something, if memory serves. And so this is a mutually beneficial relationship. The Americans run that big trade surplus with us, and so they have nothing to fear.
Have there been any further talks?
From the responsible steps we're taking in Whyalla.
Have there been any further talks with the Trump administration about the steel and aluminium tariffs that he's threatening?
Well, tonight, David, I'll be departing for Washington, D.C. To hold one-on-one conversations with my Treasury counterpart, the U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. This won't be the first time that I've met with Secretary Bessent, but the first time since he was confirmed in that new role. And trade and tariffs will be part of the conversation, but not the whole conversation. That's an ongoing discussion that we are having with our American counterparts. I don't expect to conclude those discussions on steel and aluminium while I'm in DC. But whether it's the flow of capital or critical minerals and trade, there's lots to talk about. This is a relationship which benefits both sides, the Americans and the Australians. I'll also be addressing the superannuation summit that you mentioned in your introduction. That's all about stronger returns for Australians from stronger ties with the American economy. So lots to talk about when I sit down with my counterpart, Scott Bessent, in DC in the first half of this week.
Well, that's really interesting, and that's going to be an important meeting given a decision is due by Donald Trump by, I think it's March 12, on the tariffs. So you'll no doubt make the case on Australia's part as to why they shouldn't be imposed. If they are, do you agree this would damage the relationship?
Well, I'm not going to preempt the outcome of those discussions, nor do I expect that those discussions will necessarily be concluded this week, to be upfront with you. Prime Minister Albanese had a very productive conversation with President Trump My colleagues Penny Wong and Richard Marles have similarly met with our counterparts already. I think that augurs well for the strength of the relationship, but I'm not going to predict or preempt the outcomes of those discussions. I'm looking forward to meeting with Secretary Bessent again, but for the first time since he's been sworn into his new role.
And just on Donald Trump, I mean, I know this is outside your lane a bit as Treasurer, but the comments that he's made this over the past week about Vladimir Zelensky being a dictator, about Ukraine starting the war, I mean, you know, just bring us inside the thinking in the government on this. You know, this is someone who is clearly wanting to overhaul the trading system that we've seen in place for 80 years, and now alliances being put at risk, really upsetting the Europeans and obviously Ukraine as well. How concerned are you about all of this?
Well, we say the same things privately as we say publicly when it comes to Ukraine. The Australian position is very clear and it's been really consistent. You know, the war started because of Russian aggression. President Zelensky is the elected leader of a courageous country. Our support for Ukraine has been unwavering and that will continue. We've said that Ukraine obviously needs to be part of any peace discussions, and we're pleased to see Secretary Rubio confirm that that will be the case.
Donald Trump, we know, wants allies to boost defence spending. Ours, I think, has just ticked under 2%, but it's due to get to 2.4% of GDP. Can you go higher? Can you get to 3% or more? Or is that impossible?
I wouldn't anticipate that we get to 3%, David, but it has been increasing on our watch. It is substantially higher than the trajectory that we inherited in dollar terms, and it means around 2% now growing over the coming years. And that extra investment will help us make a contribution to the work that we do with our partners and allies, including our American friends. And so that investment has been going up. It's part of the case that we make to the Americans when it comes to the very important strategic but also economic relationship between two great countries.
And look, just finally, Treasurer, before I let you go, have you made a decision yet on the on whether you'll allow the Qatar Airways bid for 25% of Virgin?
Well, I received that advice from the Foreign Investment Review Board this weekend, and I'll weigh up that advice. I hope to make that decision pretty swiftly. Ideally this week, if I can. I will weigh up all of the considerations in the Foreign Investment Review Board's advice. I'll make a decision which is consistent with our national economic interest, but people should expect to see that decision quite soon, ideally this week.
All right. Amidst your quick trip to Washington, Treasurer Jim Chalmers, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much, David.
All right, and we're going to have more on, well, that visit to Washington the Treasurer has just announced. It will be at a critical moment as the Trump administration considers those tariffs. Let's get back to the panel. We're joined once again by Jacob Greber, Jennifer Hewitt and Shane Wright. Just a couple of things out of that interview I want to just note. Quotas on the use of local steel, Jacob. This is something that's under consideration, he said. I think various state and governments and federal governments over the years have had targets and so on. You've got to use so much Aussie steel. Mm. A quota, though, would be something else altogether, wouldn't it?
Look, I think it's part of a bigger trend where we're going to see much more direct action involvement by government in these sort of assets. Mm. Frankly, the opposition is going to do this with nuclear. It'll be government-owned, government-run, you know, at least in its initial phase. And I think... My mail is that equity will also be a part. It's on the table as a potential part of Whyalla. Yeah. And that's because of the way the pots of money work. They're talking about using the Reconstruction Fund and the Clean Energy Finance Corp. They do take equity stakes in these sorts of investments. Regardless, really, of what form it takes, whether it's quotas, whether it's equity, the government now owns this problem in a sense. You know, they've taken it over, the South Australian government, and passed that legislation during the week. And so that's where we're headed with this. And it's not simple. The Treasurer didn't talk about what green steel is. The conventional view of that is that that's hydrogen.
Yeah, and that's been put on the shelf.
Hydrogen's been sort of in retreat in the last few months. But blue steel would be involving gas. So, look, it's a very complicated area.
Well, the blue iron fund.
Sorry, yeah,
the green iron fund.
Right.
But on the use of quotas, this would affect construction projects, presumably. I don't know what they're going to decide here, but it could see construction projects, be it transport, port.
Yes, well, Australia's already, and companies have already made use of Australia's anti-dumping commission and to try and kind of prevent competition from lower-priced Chinese steel. But I think what is very clear is you're going to see that increase at just the same time that you're going to have probably a lot of cheaper steel. And that difference, that big price differential, of course, makes it very, very hard for all sorts of other manufacturers to kind of keep competitive themselves. So there's always a catch in these things. And I think it's going to be a very difficult economic decision. You already saw the Prime Minister talking about, you know, going back to his favourite topic, we should make more solar panels here. We should make more wind turbines here, you know. I think that's a very dubious kind of proposition.
We're in a new world, Jennifer. We're in a new world.
Yes, I know. But none of this, of course, will be clear until well after the election.
And there's 22,000 people in Whyalla, and what is it, 3,000 of them directly depend on that steel mill. Like, that's the political function of this whole thing.
And they want their steel used.
And we have seen, like, Donald Trump just playing to that, right, yes, we're going to put tariffs up because we're going to protect your job. Working class, in the US case, white men... jobs.
And also this week there was a glassmaker that's run into trouble here in Australia because a lot of glass is coming now from China, frankly.
But the other issue...
It gets very hard then to draw lines as to how far government should intervene.
What's a critical industry?
What is also very critical is the cost of energy. And that'll be what the opposition is banging on about. Doesn't mean they've got the answers, but that is what's driving so many manufacturers to the wall because of the cost of power.
Jim Chalmers off tonight to Washington. He'll be at that summit, but importantly meet his counterpart, Scott Bessent, as well. We've had pretty good access, really, when you think Penny Wong, Richard Marles, now Jim Chalmers, early on to their counterparts, and the Prime Minister, obviously, with Donald Trump as well over the phone. This will be an important chat, though, before the decision on tariffs, won't it?
Well, this is interesting because Bessent is not a I love tariffs sort of guy.
Yeah, just who is he?
Like, he's come out of the corporate side of Wall Street, effectively.
Right.
And so his understanding of economics is not the same as Donald Trump's view of the world.
He's pro-tariff, though?
Not as pro as...
not as gung-ho, like a Pete Navarro.
No. And Navarro is way out there in that space.
So he's a more moderating influence on Donald Trump.
He is, look, we have seen over the last, the month and a bit that we've had of Donald Trump, that he is just pushing and pushing anything that has been the established approach to economics, to foreign affairs, to Ukraine. It's just been cast out the window.
And look, I want to talk about Ukraine because I know, every week we seem to be talking about Donald Trump lately, but every week there is something rather extraordinary he says, exactly. And when it comes to Ukraine, I mean, have a look at what he said.
You've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal.
A dictator without elections. Zelensky better move fast or he's not going to have a country left. Got to move.
I mean, suggesting Vladimir Zelensky started the war and is a dictator, I mean, these are Vladimir Putin's talking points, aren't they, Jacob?
Yes, and these talking points are causing problems for our domestic political framing. You can see both sides sort of struggling with this because it is so extreme. It's frankly sort of way out there. Dutton leapt in this week to condemn those comments, said they're dead wrong. Mm. You just heard the Treasurer reiterate that Ukraine was invaded by an aggressor.
But he was very careful not to criticise Trump.
So both of them are having to play this sort of dance with a complete sort of shake-up of the global order. And there are, for Peter Dutton, he doesn't want to be associated with this version of Trumpism because... Mm-hmm. One suspects Australian voters might be a little bit sort of worried about it.
Just to demonstrate that, I'll show you here, Peter Dutton and Anthony Albanese, this slightly different tone from the two, both very strongly expressing Australia's bipartisan view on Ukraine was invaded by Russia, we support Ukraine. But Peter Dutton was a bit more willing to give Donald Trump a whack.
I think he's dead wrong in relation to Ukraine and some of the public commentary that we've seen. It just doesn't accord with the facts.
Well, I speak for Australia's interest, and Australia stands with Ukraine in their struggle.
Yeah, so he's being a bit more careful, the Prime Minister, not to poke Trump in the eye here. But your point, Jacob, that why is Peter Dutton more willing to go there? Is he trying to show the electorate that, you know, after calling him, a great strategic thinker and big ideas, and he appointed Jacinda Price as the government efficiencies are and so on. But he's now showing, hang on, I'm not mini Trump.
Yes, he can't afford to be.
He can't afford to embrace this full Trump agenda because it doesn't appear at this stage. Now, maybe the election will prove us all wrong, but voters don't respond to that in this country. They're alarmed by some of this stuff. Albanese is taking more of a I'm not going to comment on everything Donald Trump says approach, and that I think is also, there's criticism of Albanese for that approach, that it's sort of hiding behind the couch. He's not up front on why this is a problem. You get the impression he'd rather this wasn't part of the space at the moment.
Yeah, well,
Labor does not want to be talking about foreign affairs.
I think many would like...
Wouldn't, obviously, but I do think this is a problem for the Albanese government. I mean, they obviously don't want to attract the ire, but he's already got this problem with looking a bit weak in terms of how the public perceives him. I think the inability to say anything about Trump being completely out of line in his comments feeds into that. And I do think that's an issue.
It is, like, some of what Trump has talked about. Like, he is saying, I want half of the revenue that Ukraine gets from its critical minerals, oil and gas. Like, there is a description for that. That's a protection racket. Organised crime would be absolutely salivating at the idea, we'll protect you, but you just give us half of everything that you've got.
Like, Singapore...
It's not money. It's organised crime being dressed up as foreign affairs at the moment. That is a difficult space for any Prime Minister or opposition leader to deal with.
Singapore, which is always incredibly polite about everything, I noticed one of their ministers saying that the US was sounding more like a greedy landlord than any kind of foreign policy partner.
So some are willing to lean.
Yeah, so and including the Europeans, including the British. So that's what I mean. I think it's I don't think the Albanese government, it's understandable as a government they don't want to draw Trump's ire, but I do think he's got to be more clear on that.
How's Ukraine feeling about all of this? I had a really interesting conversation with Ukraine's ambassador to Australia, Vasyl Moroshenchenko, for the podcast this week. He was also very reluctant to criticise Trump. And, you know, even though he's saying all these things about Zelensky and Ukraine starting the war there, they're being very careful in their reaction to all of this. He did say that they may end up with occupied territory. They're not going to cede that territory to Russia. But he did venture that, you know, this may end up being occupied territory. And also they may end up not being part of NATO, but they do want some sort of US security guarantee. It may not be necessarily NATO membership, but some sort of US security guarantee.
Exactly.
So Crimea, off the table?
Off the table for Ukraine. I mean, it could be just occupied, as it has been occupied now for 11 years, Crimea, as well as other parts of Ukraine.
Anyway, you can watch that full interview there with the QR codes, but it could end up with Crimea and perhaps Donetsk being occupied. But, you know, that is not going to be an ideal solution for Ukraine, obviously.
Well, the ambassador is talking about like ceding part of his sovereign territory. Like that's where we've got to. The rewarding.
He's not. Well, he's not saying. He's not saying.
But
ceding.
This is why you can see the Ukrainians are in such a difficult position because so much is now tied to the ramblings of Donald Trump.
Yeah. No, exactly. Anyway, Wayala, let's just unpack a bit more about that. We talked about the fact that they you know may end up with an equity stake in this, but the money they have put on the table, $2.4 billion, the clear message from all concerned was that this is not a bailout.
Not a bailout for GFG.
There is no bailout here of GFG.
Not a bailout. First thing to mention, this is not a bailout.
Is it a bailout?
Yes, it's a bailout.
Don't protest too much.
It's definitely a bailout. They're making the distinction, of course. They're not bailing out Sanjeev Gupta because, of course, they don't want to have anything to do with him. But they are bailing out the company and the industry. And that's a big... you can understand why they've done it. You can understand why the opposition is very quick to say, yes, we'll do the same. But it's a very big certainly a very big gamble, and it will be with taxpayers' money in terms of being ever being a profitable enterprise without a lot of protection.
And you know, whether it's bailout or call it what you want, we've seen governments do this in the past. But what they did, what the state government did in terms of passing legislation in a heartbeat to take the company off Sanjeev Gupta and put it in the hands of administrators. I haven't seen that before.
That's unparalleled.
It's a new trick.
That was a new trick, but it gives you the idea, the notion of just how angry South Australians are with Gupta's company and what he's got up to. But there's also that trade-off. We can't lose Whyalla. We can't lose those tens of thousands of jobs that are tied to it. And where South Australia ends up. It's a big argument for that. It's a relatively small economy. What's going on there?
The Chinese warships, a second live firing yesterday. The New Zealand frigate that detected that, and then on the Friday was the initial incident that saw Qantas and Jetstar pilots have to reroute around the area concerned. The Prime Minister's pointed out they're entitled to do this in international waters. Richard Marles sounding a little more concerned.
Look, I don't think we have a satisfactory answer from China in relation to this. What happened yesterday was that the notice that was provided was very short. It was obviously very disconcerting for the airlines involved in Trans-Tasman flights, and flights that had already taken off were then in a situation of needing to divert their course around the task group, and that was obviously disconcerting. The issue that we've raised with China is the period of notice, really.
Disconcerting. It's provocative too, isn't it, Jacob?
I was trying to picture being one of those Virgin or Qantas or Air New Zealand pilots getting a direct call, as we're told happened, from this warship, you know, take a right turn or else. I mean, this is pretty extraordinary stuff. One suspects if we were doing that in the South China Sea, for instance, Straits of Taiwan, the reaction would be very dramatic.
But we do it. We just give more notice.
You give notice.
Firing, but we're not doing
we don't
firing.
Disrupt flights, I'm pretty sure. It sends a very strong message. It's happening just as we're on the cusp of an election.
Yeah, so why now? Is it election related or is it just...
It's a nice little reminder that there are these big, very dramatic and frankly very unsettling geopolitical changes underway. You might be having a domestic debate here about bulk billing and whatever it might be on the day. There are these big, ugly things unfolding offshore, and China's provided a nice little reminder.
And it's also, I think, again, difficult for the government in the sense that they have talked about, they've calmed down the rhetoric and therefore they've stabilised the relationship and everything's just fine. Pretty well. And then this is a very big reminder that stabilisation doesn't mean that China's not going to take actions like this and be deliberately...
Well, exactly. And we had a couple of weeks ago flares being fired in front of a surveillance aircraft in the South China Sea. So these incidents are continuing. I mean, everyone's scratching their head. Is this because of the election? Is it simply to show that, well, tit for tat, you do it in our backyard, we'll do it in yours? Is it Trump-related? Everyone's distracted by what's going on.
Everything's Trump-related, but this puts into perspective all those rock lobsters that we're now moving back over to China. That was, yay, we've got our rock lobsters. Oh, hold on, they're firing.
Yeah, hang on a minute.
They're firing missiles just off the city heads.
You can sort of see the government sort of doing the DFAT sort of quietly, the DFAT talking point. And I'm sure there's lots and lots of very good sort of deep state, deep sort of strategic reasons for doing that. I shouldn't say deep state, I didn't mean that. I mean sort of deep thinking about how these forces are all going head to head. But at some point, the government sort of needs to talk in a language that maybe Joe Bloggs down the road can understand about the consequence here of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where the government leaves itself a little bit vulnerable to Dutton being able to sort of jump into this space.
Final one. Clive Palmer is back with his big checkbook. He failed to re-register his United Australia Party, but he has come up with a new name, the Trumpet of Patriots. Now, it's all about riding that Trump wave. He's echoing, he's spouting all of the Trump ideas, whether it's on gender or cutting government waste and so on. And clearly, he is willing to spend big once again.
I'm more than happy to spend my funds on something productive, defending the right of free speech, and whatever's required to be spent, it'll be spent.
whatever's required will be spent. Will it make a difference this time, or will it be another $100 million for one ineffective senator?
Let's say Blaxland, Chifley, Lindsay, one in 10 voters voted for either One Nation or UAP at the last election. In Bruce, Scullin and Holt around the outer suburbs of Melbourne, it was one in seven.
Mm.
There is a reason Donald Trump's successful,
yep.
And this is a reason why Clive Palmer and Pauline Hanson are targeting into the same area.
So, I mean, that's not nothing.
That is very important.
And so what could that do in terms of at least the preferences being directed one way or another?
Absolutely. And it was around 70-30, those preferences flowed back to the Liberal Party. Then again, in Melbourne, you had the Victorian Socialists also picking up support. Their preferences flowed the other way, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's kind of good news for the Labor Party, let's face it. But at the same time, it will also take some votes away from the Liberals, clearly. But they don't man the booths apparently particularly well, and obviously in all the seats. But it will obviously have an impact on preferences, and it's just a demonstration of why the Labor Party is so nervous.
The name's interesting. It's because the United Australia Party was ruled out of order. Trumpet of Patriots. I think Clive even mispronounced it at one point. Trumpet of Parrots. It was sort of it's Freudian slip, maybe. But I think we also learned this week that was interesting. This comes after there was a move to try and unify some of these parties. Clive Palmer, Pauline Hanson. I'm told they also looked at Bob Katter's sort of operation to try and sort of create a unified, I guess, Australian
instead
first
of cacophony.
And I think it points to the fact that a lot of these figureheads from these particular movements are sort of one-person shows, and they're like an old sort of band, you know, it's starting to get a bit tired. They're certainly not sure who comes next. It's not obvious what the next generation of a Pauline Hanson is, and she started, you know, in her 30s. Who's sort of the new figurehead for...
As we've seen from the US, maybe it's the geriatric's turn.
It may well be, but it's still a very important part of the electorate for the reasons that you've explained, that these are preference-harvesting outfits, and the major parties get swept in some seats either way.
Let's get some final observations. Shane?
Timing of the federal budget, saying I've just declared it's not going to be March 25. This will come down to what happens at the election in terms of if it's a hung parliament, the public service can't work through projects from either side. So the idea of a May budget is, if we get to that point, for the Labor, is in doubt. And then, say, Angus Taylor and Jane Hume, whether they will have to have an August or even an October budget, this is an open discussion going on.
Oh, it's like a dream for you,
it
though.
It is.
Budgets galore. Jennifer?
In terms of dreams and nightmare, it's easier to get caught up in the noise of the Trump administration, but the damage being done to the US alliance, particularly with Europe, is just massive. And Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron are heading to Washington this week. Is that actually going to repair some of the damage or just make it all the differences more apparent? Probably the latter.
It's going to be fascinating to watch that. Jacob?
I keep seeing Labor candidates putting up core flutes around their electorates. We are now firmly in that phase where it's not an election campaign, but it sort of is. The government gets all the benefits of still being in government. It's got all the bureaucrats still working for them. It can commandeer the planes, all that. The opposition can't, so probably time to call it now. We've got this far. Let's get this election rolling. And if your viewers want to hear more, join the new ABC podcast, Politics Now.
Good plug.
With Patricia Carvalis and occasionally myself.
Yeah, no, I know you're on there on a Monday, so no, good plug for a great podcast. Thank you all very much for joining us this morning. Finally, we've waited 13 long years for an excuse to roll this one out again. So with the Whyalla Steelworks saved by the government, here it is, Craig Emerson in all his glory back during the debate over the carbon tax. Don't block your ears. We'll leave you with that. Thanks for watching.
Well, this is the mood in Whyalla.
No Wyala wipeout there on my TV. No Wyala wipeout there on my TV. No Wyala wipeout there on my TV. Shocking me right out of my brain.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.